I'm Joe Bianca.
I'm Bill Stanley.
I'm Jonathan Green.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. This is our life's work.
Good morning. It is 9:09, Wednesday, February 17th. This is the TDN Writers Room presented by Keeneland. My name is Joe Bianca. I'm the associate editor of the Thoroughbred Daily News. Feeling very attacked watching the Australian Open in a country where it's 80 degrees and sunny and there's no pandemic to speak of.
Good morning. I'm Bill Finley, a correspondent for the Thoroughbred Daily News. And it's a huge, huge week in racing because on Friday, Fawner Park opens.
God bless Fawner Park. Jonathan Green, general manager from DJ Stable, and a special happy birthday shout out to probably the best basketball player of all time, Michael Jordan. And Joe, you might know Michael Jordan from Space Jam.
Yeah, and the Gatorade commercials too.
Exactly. He was actually a basketball player before he was a baseball player.
I was wondering why I wanted to be like Mike. That makes sense now.
And do you know the two people who were drafted ahead of Michael Jordan in the 84 draft?
Sam Bowie and who else?
And you referenced it last show.
Patrick Ewing.
No, you referenced his
Olajuwon.
Yeah, Akeem Dream. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Poor Sam Bowie got drafted number two from University of Kentucky and will ever be known as the guy who was picked before Michael Jordan, even though he had a decent career. Obviously not like Akeem Olajuwon or Michael Jordan for that matter.
And with the third pick, they made the earth sick. MJ, fade away, perfect. That's a Jay-Z line for you olds.
Oh, I thought you wrote a sonnet. I was like, wow, look at you.
You're not the only poet on this show, John.
I know it.
The TDN Writers Room is brought to you by Keeneland. A reminder that wagering through Keeneland Select supports Keeneland's efforts to give back to the thoroughbred industry as profits are reinvested back into the sport through purses, fan development, player rewards, and more. Sign up at KeenelandSelect.com. Okay, so we had a great card of races slated for Saturday at Fairgrounds, and it didn't disappoint. There was a lot of good action. We'll start with the Risen Star with Mandaloon winning and bouncing back from his favored defeat in the LeCompte. Got a 98 buyer, which is pretty damn good for this early in the season, and it goes to what we have been saying, that this is actually, I think, a really good crop of 3-year-olds. All over the country, I think you have some really nice 3-year-olds who are developing early and it's probably going to be the best May Derby field we've seen in a couple of years at least. I was a little bit disappointed in my boy Senor Buscador. However, his loss gave me 39-1 in the Derby future wager. So now I'll shut up about him until he wins the Derby at 39-1, and then you'll never hear the end of it from me. He's, Bill said that he had Todd Fincher on his show on Saturday, and that this was just a stepping stone for him, which makes sense. I still think he's got a ton of talent, but he's got to show a little bit of speed. It's not going to work out for him dropping. If he drops back in every single race, he drops that far back in the Derby. He's gonna have to rely on a pace meltdown, and that doesn't usually happen. As for the winner, it's just the story I think of this season so far is Brad Cox and Bob Baffert. Now, if I gave you 2-1 right now that either Brad Cox or Bob Baffert is going to win the Kentucky Derby, would you guys take that? Because it seems like they kind of have it cornered right now. They each have 3 or 4 major contenders. Obviously, there's a lot still to happen and still to develop on the Derby trail. Shug McGahee's got an interesting horse in Greatest Honor. There's a couple other horses from other trainers. Brendan Walsh might put Prevalence in the Fountain of Youth. We'll see if that happens and how he runs. But overall, Cox and Baffert, they've just dominated the prep season so far, and it's going to be tough to beat their respective contingents on the first Saturday in May. I'll toss it to you guys in a minute, but I just wanted to run down a couple other things on the card. Clarier beat Travel Column in a pretty good renewal of the Rachel Alexandra. You only got an 85 buyer, but I think those are two pretty nice fillies and might maybe working on a nice rivalry here after they went 1-2 in the Goldenrod. And then my boy Maxfield, he's not the most brilliant horse in the world, but man, is he a pleasure to watch. He's just a beautiful, big, strapping horse who just, when he gets going, it looks extremely powerful on the racetrack. He got a 99 Byron winning the Mineshaft. Obviously, he's the kind of horse who I think is going to develop as the season goes on. And just, you know, basically, just from a basic standpoint, to see him run back-to-back races without going to the shelf, I think is a big accomplishment for him. Never mind that he's 5-for-5 now. He's undefeated in his career. Just to be able to string races together for a horse who's had a lot of trouble staying on the racetrack, I think is a big deal. And I think he's gonna have a big year if he can stay healthy. There's a couple other things I wanted to talk about from the weekend, but I'll toss it over to you guys.
Yeah, Joe, all good points. Let's start with Maxfield. I think he was the story of the weekend, even on a weekend where there was a Kentucky Derby prep. And yeah, I agree. I mean, this horse was always about his potential. I mean, he's winning, you know, he wasn't able to run in the big races, the Breeders' Cup, the Triple Crown races. But everybody said, what's going to happen when he does get right, which he is now, and when he puts it all together? And that certainly seems to be happening right now. You know, again, did he beat a grade one field? No. Did he win by 20 lengths? No. But everything about the way he won, he was just totally in charge in that race. And I think it's now he's ready to go to the next level, which is big time stardom. Brendan Walsh hasn't said as much. I don't quite understand why, but isn't it obvious that he's going to the Dubai World Cup right now after this? I mean, he's owned by Sheikh Mohammed. It's the premier race in his own country, and he would go into that and be one of the horses to beat. So I would think that that'll be his real big test. Brad Cox is talking about Nick Sko running in that after the Saudi race, so we'll see what happens there. So yeah, Maxfield was really, really good. Everything you said about the Risen Star, I totally agree with. You know, the story this year is as much about people as it is about horses. And, you know, we get Baffert, but I think even Brad Cox is a bigger story because, you know, we've been seeing this from Baffert for 25 years, that he's showing up in the Kentucky Derby with a couple contenders and he's going to win more than his fair share of Kentucky Derbies. But, I mean, the Cox brand just keeps exploding, gets bigger and bigger all the time. Even though he didn't win the Rachel Alexandra with Travel Column, she ran a really nice race to finish second. And, yeah, don't give up on your pal, Senor Buscador. I did have on my SiriusXM show on Saturday. Top Venture said, you know, I'm really going to bring him to peek into the Derby. But I think you're right about that. I mean, if he just gets hopelessly well behind all those horses in every race, he is going to be in trouble. But Venture said that there's really nothing he can do about it. That's just the way the horse runs. And kind of a minor race, but it might be worth mentioning that Rombauer won the El Camino Real Derby just because he was coming out of the Breeders' Cup where he finished kind of a even fifth, which shows that maybe the Breeders' Cup, as we all expected last year, did have some quality. Whereas in the 2019 Breeders' Cup Juvenile, I mean, none of those horses have ever come back to do anything. So he was one of the first horses to come out of the Breeders' Cup. But two thumbs up for Maxfield, thumbs up for Clarianne, and for Senior Buscador.
Yeah, and the spotlight really did shine on the fairgrounds, especially with Oaklawn having to scrap their entire weekend and now week. It looks like everything's going to get pushed off even further. So, you know, all of the major preps that were going on for the Oaks and for the Derby were landing in the fairgrounds. Ironically enough, you know, right on the eve of, you know, of Fat Tuesday and Mardi Gras, which looks like it's going to be, you know, kind of tempered down, if not, you know, canceled altogether. But be that as it may, let's focus on some of the races that were going on in the fairgrounds. You guys mentioned all the high points, and certainly Maxfield winning, you know, he should have. He was 4-to-5. I mean, that in the morning line, that's what those kind of horses are supposed to do. But what's really impressive about Maxfield is that every race he seems to get better, at least on the statistics, at least on the sheet numbers, at least on the buyer numbers. Every single race he's improving on the previous one, which is really difficult to do 5 races into your career. So, you know, Brendan Walsh is doing a great job campaigning him, managing him, knocking the rust off from the layoff, you know, and running him in an easy $75,000 added stake, stepping him up to a grade 3. And now he's ready to take on some of the big boys. And really at this point in time, because he won a grade 1 as a 2-year-old, all he's doing is padding his resume. So, you know, that camp has the option of really picking and choosing what races they want to go into, because it's not like they have to work backwards from, you know, fill in the blank stallion, you know, grade 1 race. Okay. They already have that on their resume. If they get another one, that's even better. But for right now, they can really pick and choose where they want to go with them. And I think they've done a very good job of managing Maxfield. And it's fun to watch him run, because he is, you know, he's got some tactical speed. He can sit off it. He can sit way off it like he's done in previous races. And I think he was just so much better in the mine shaft that he was a lot closer than in previous races. And that's a really good sign to see again, that he's progressing and getting better as he's getting older. You know, you guys mentioned the Risen Star. I wasn't crazy about the Risen Star as far as the finish. Mandaloon is a nice horse, obviously, you know, ran a big, almost 100 buyer with the blinkers on for the first time. And that was a really impressive, you know, move that he had. I don't know if I would pick him yet, you know, in my draft, you know, next week, but certainly he's a horse that you know, bears watching and noticing. And I'm going to shift a little bit away from the Fairgrounds just to one other race that went on over the weekend. And that was Mischievous Alex winning the Gulfstream Park Sprint. Wow. He was really impressive. And I noticed that they put an extension blinker on him, you know, for the race. And that may have really focused him. But, you know, he did it the right way. And again, small field, you know, scratched down to like a 4 or 5 horse field, if I remember correctly. But he just did it the right way. He sat, you know, right there, made other horses, you know, fall by the wayside as he kind of wore them down. And then down the stretch just exploded. So it was great to see, you know, that horse win for our friends at Cassius King and LC Racing. And he looks like that now that they've kind of figured him out and they're going to keep him, you know, sprinting at the 3/4 mark. He looks like a serious contender for later on in the year for the Breeders' Cup Sprint.
Yeah, John stole my thunder there. Usually I'm stealing his thunder. Yeah, I said this after the race on Twitter that to me, he's the best sprinter in the country until I see otherwise. Now, I'm going to keep that at 6 furlongs because, you know, maybe Charlatan ends up being a 7 furlong horse. You know, I would take Charlatan over him, obviously, but at 6 furlongs, especially considering the weakness of the Breeders' Cup Sprint last year, I think he's the guy for that division. You know, maybe Nashville comes back and bounces back at 6 furlongs. He's the only other one I can really think of that I could possibly take over him. But yeah, 4 horse field, short field. So it wasn't obviously the greatest group of horses he was beating, but did it the right way. He really accelerated when he was asked, and just the race was never in doubt, even if he was close, even if the race was close for the first 1/4 mile or 1/2 mile or so. So yeah, he's super impressive and I'm interested to see what he does the rest of the year. I brought him up last week on the show that I was looking forward to seeing him run. He didn't disappoint. As far as Maxfield, you know, I think this is just follows the pattern of Brendan Walsh and the way he trains. He's a very patient guy. He's a very conservative guy. You know, even just going back to Prevalence, he's talking about maybe not going in the Fountain of Youth because there's an allowance race at Gulfstream, 2-turn allowance, 2 days before the Fountain of Youth next Thursday. So he might go in there instead of the Fountain of Youth, which, you know, that kind of puts a little bit of pressure on where he's going to run next, because he's going to need the Derby points to get into the field. But he's just the kind of guy that's not going to, you know, not going to step on the gas all the time. He's going to take his time and do right by the horse. And that especially, it goes double for Maxfield, I think, especially because he's had the physical issues that he's had. But he's in a good spot, I think, if he does go to the Dubai World Cup, like Bill said, because, you know, we're going to talk about the Saudi Cup in a little bit, but, you know, there's a good chance that Nick Sko and Charlatan beat each other up so much on Saturday that they're maybe a little weary in 4 weeks after that. And he's the kind of horse who could ship in fresh and pick them off, even if, you know, right now he's not as fast as them on paper. I think he's potentially in a really good spot if that's the route that they choose to go. But either way, we all want to see him stay healthy and on the track and run this year, because he's so much fun to look at and to see run. So I'm excited to watch him going forward. Just a couple other results I wanted to mention from the weekend. In the Santa Monica, Bob Baffert runs 1-2-3, and the trifecta paid $434. I don't know when the last time Bob Baffert in 1-2-3 was, and the thing paid that. Merneith was 9-1. She won the race. She got a 97 buyer. So she's pretty. She's a horse that flash talent last year as a 3-year-old. I remember she had like a big maiden win in the slop at Oak Lawn, won by like a dozen lengths or so, and then never really got going when it came to stakes company. So she might be a late bloomer for Bob Baffert as a 4-year-old. And then in Aqueduct races in the Gander on Monday or Sunday, I believe, which was a New York bred race, Nikki the Vest, who was the first stakes winner the first stakes winner for Run Happy, who got a little bit of a slow start at the stud, but I think his horses are starting to come on now. There's 3-year-olds. He won by 11 3/4 lengths, only got an 83 buyer. So it's obviously not the toughest field that he was facing. But it was kind of interesting that the runner up in that race, Lobsta, was a full brother to Chowda, who won the Great Gander last year for Gary Siaka. So he's probably going to step into open company next time. I think he's going to run the Gotham. That's what trainer Jonathan Thomas was hinting at. But he's a horse that is big and has a lot of talent. He's only run twice. So he's one to look forward to in the next couple of preps from the New York division. But I think overall, it seems as if the New York horses right now are a little bit behind the Louisiana horses and the Florida horses when it comes to the Derby in terms of speed, in terms of how much they've run, in terms of conditioning. So that's going to be something to watch for, you know, as the prep races develop. I think they're a little bit behind right now, California, Florida, Louisiana. But overall, super, super crop of 3-year-olds. Really exciting. I'm literally looking forward to next week's fantasy draft. So that was a success last year. We had a lot of fun with that. We're going to bring Brian and possibly Al back on the show next week to do the fantasy draft. I think we're going to do 5 horses each with no supplemental draft, because too many people on this show who will not be named have been whining about the supplemental draft.
But they got kicked off the show because they were whining so much. Can we?
Yeah, we banished Brian into the ether for complaining too much about the supplemental draft. So we're looking forward to that. And then next Saturday, of course, is the Fountain of Youth. Not a ton to look forward to this Saturday, other than the Saudi Cup. Pretty quiet weekend of racing in America. Then, you know, the last week of February, and then going into March, we're going to have a lot more action. Before we talk about the Saudi Cup, and I feel like we've talked a little bit about, you know, about the Knicks Go Charlatan matchup. I don't know what else there really is to talk about in that race, but I just wanted to mention the Oaklawn thing, because I don't remember the last time I've seen a track have to cancel multiple weeks of racing like this, especially in the heart of 3-year-old season. Now, we were previewing this last week, and it immediately was moot after we went off the air that they canceled the Southwest. We wanted to see a Central Qualities 3-year-old debut. A lot of people are really anticipating that. Jackie's Warrior is supposed to be in that race as well. Keep Me in Mind. So a couple of potential top Derby contenders, they had to cancel because of the inclement weather. And just wanted to say, anybody who's in the South or in Texas in that area right now, hope you guys are hanging in there and pulling through. It's a really tough situation with what's going on with their power grid and the freezing temperatures. But yeah, I mean, this brings up an interesting thing in terms of what Brad Cox and these trainers do with the horses that were pointing in the Southwest. I assume they're still going to run in those races, but now you're talking about postponing the race 2 weeks to where you only have a 2-week break between the Southwest and the Rebel. And, you know, Bill's probably going to jump on me for saying 2 weeks is too short to be coming back, but it's definitely a factor. And, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, I the thing is, like, everybody, there's no big race this weekend. I think if the Fountain of Youth was this Saturday, you might see a couple of those horses reroute to there, but they're kind of stuck now because there's no big preps until the following weekend and the San Felipe. So, I mean, what are they going to do? They kind of are, you know, prescribed to running in this race now, but I think it's going to throw a little bit of a wrench into the prep schedule. And I think it's going to affect the Rebel, where you're going to see a lot of horses run in the Southwest and then skip the Rebel and then run in the Arkansas Derby. Whereas I think, you know, a lot of times you want to keep them on that 3 prep schedule heading into the Derby. But, you know, it was a little disappointing not to be able to see those big horses these next 2 weeks. But we hope everything at Oakland and in the South, you know, gets straightened out, and the weather changes. This is our world now. This is our world. You know, there's really no predicting how many and how severe these weather events are going to be, you know, all over the country, all over the world. We saw the wildfires in Australia and California. Temperatures are warmer than ever pretty much across the globe, you know, and now you're seeing these ridiculous cold snaps in places where it really has never been that cold before, or at least extremely rarely been that cold before. And it's, you know, it's a slow rolling disaster, which is why we don't do anything about it, at least in America. But it's definitely something that people should, you know, get their heads out of their asses about, that this is going to be a bigger and bigger problem going forward because of climate change. But anyway, that's mini rant. I don't know if that's good enough for the 2021 rant reel. But I don't know if you guys have any thoughts about the Southwest being postponed, but we do have the Saudi Cup this Saturday. It's $20 million on the line. I don't know that there's any other horse in there that you really think is a grade one horse, let alone a $20 million horse other than Knicks Go and Charlton. But, you know, that's a marquee matchup, and that's about as good of a matchup as you're going to see this year, I think, on the racetrack. The race will go off at 12:40 Eastern time on Saturday, which is 8:40 Saudi Arabia time. The draw is tonight. So unfortunately we're not going to get to see the full field until after tonight, but you know, I don't know what else to say about it other than, you know, it's an interesting matchup from a pace standpoint too, beyond the immense talent that both of these horses have. It's going to be tough, I think, for them to lay off each other, especially if there's other speed in the race. Wonder what you guys are expecting in the Saudi Cup.
Yeah, it's going to be a tremendous matchup and really something that, you know, everybody's looking forward to seeing. I mean, right now, these are far and away the two best older horses older dirt horses in the world. And again, the pace scenario, just like you said, Joe, I mean, something's got to give there. I mean, they both want to be on the front end. I think the draw will have some impact here, as I think whoever draws inside of the other will be more likely to take the lead and have the other horse sit outside and stalk in that position. So we'll see. I don't know the first thing about any of the foreign horses in there. I can't imagine any of them could even come close to warming up Charlotte and then Knicks Go. You have Tacitus. He's guaranteed to either be third or fourth, as we know. And then Sleepy Eyes Todd, who, by the way, won at Fawner Park last year. He's going from Fawner Park to Saudi Arabia to the Sleepy Eyes Todd. And then Max
Play. Is there a bonus for that, Bill? Is there a Fawner Park?
Big, yeah, you get $1.45 off at and your next fill up at the pump and pay. I mean, it's something we're really looking forward to. It should be a tremendous race. And, you know, again, like you said, Joe, I think even though it's a race that, you know, we're all looking forward to, there's not a whole lot to say. It looks like a two-horse race on paper. The tactics will be really fascinating. And whoever emerges from this, if it is one of the two, I can't imagine anybody else can win this, will be, you know, far and away recognized as the best horse in America. And at this point in time, the leading contender for horse of the year.
Yeah, no question about it. I just hope that the winner gets paid this year. That's the most important thing, because that means that they tested clean and everything was good. And we can go on moving forward as an industry. You know, you guys have pretty much, put the lid on the importance of the Saudi Cup. It really comes down to those two horses. And that's the reason why I would stay up and watch it, just to see, ultimately who gets the lead and if it's taken away from them by the other major competitor.
You're going to stay up all the way past 12:40 p.m., John?
No, I'm going to go to sleep at 8 like I usually do. And then when I wake up for the second time at night to pee, that's around 12:30. So something
not
to look forward
to. A.M.
A.M. Yeah, no, something to look forward to.
The race is at 12:40 p.m. Eastern.
Oh, I thought it was 12:40. I thought it was just after midnight. Oh, okay. Yeah. Oh, all right. Yeah. Well, yeah. Then I'll be right. I'll be at my second nap at that point.
Because I remember being out.
He would have then. If you shouldn't have said anything, then he would get up in the middle of the night to watch a test pattern on Fox Sports 1.
Exactly. But the negative is I would have tweeted you guys. I would have been like, hey, what's going on?
Obsessively texting me, where's the Saudi Cup?
Exactly. But I did want to go back to one thing, actually, Joe, that you mentioned about Nikki DeVest, who was the New York bred. I think we're done with the Saudi Cup, right? We've addressed it. It's going to be a good race. Nikki DeVest ran against New York breds again and won very impressively by almost 12 lengths. But, you know, the guy that we never talk about, we don't talk about young trainers that often, but Jonathan Thomas actually doesn't have a lot of horses. He's only had 15 starts this year, and he's had 8 wins. And a second and 3/3. So 53% win and almost 75% in the money. And yet we're not talking about this guy. And every year he has, 100 or 150 starts, 20% win percentage, 24%, 25%, 30%. I mean, the guy's a young trainer. He knows how to train, it sounds like. And it'd be interesting to see if he can campaign, this horse into some of the Derby preps and ultimately some of the Triple Crown races.
Okay, so we've never done this before on the show. and we do these interviews and then we never speak of them again. They just go in the can and then go on the shelf and go into the archive, like at the end of Raiders of the Lost Ark. But you know, last week we had a very, very important interview with Travis Tiger, the CEO of USADA. And if you haven't seen it, you should go watch it. The podcast and the interview segment by itself are both on YouTube. So go Google that, or go YouTube that, or Google it, and it'll pop up. So it was a huge get for us because, you know, he doesn't do a ton of interviews. He's a little bit more of a guy who likes to do his work kind of, you know, behind the scenes. But he was, I thought, a great interview, an absolutely tremendous interview. And it was just so important, I thought, to have him and to have that discussion, because there is so much, there's so much ambiguity about how this sport is going to be policed in the Heisa era. So I thought he was not going to say anything too specific or too, you know, with too much conviction. I thought he was going to be vague and kind of, you know, vague questions a little bit. And that wasn't the case at all. He was extremely forthcoming, and I thought just gave, you know, perfect answers basically to everything that we asked. And we were joking about it, that like, when we got off the air, we had to like fan ourselves because we were so excited about that interview. And John's a little embarrassed that I talked about how he got the vapors from the Travis Tiger interview. But, you know, it was just so great to hear this kind of clarity and confidence about, you know, getting cheaters and drug trainers out of the sport and actually regulating it on a national level. And he just, you know, even if he doesn't know the exact, you know, all the ins and outs and all the nuts and bolts, as he said, of the industry, he wants to learn that, and his crew wants to learn that. And at the end of the day, you know, it's like I said last week, it's a moral obligation to get the juice trainers out of racing, because racing is dangerous enough as it is, to then add the variable of drugged up horses who are running through infirmities and becoming more susceptible to fatally breaking down. I think it's a moral imperative for the sport to get rid of that as much as we possibly can. And he just, you know, he spoke with so much clarity and so much confidence that, you know, the people, he said that there's going to be a grace period where, you know, the rules are going to be, you know, come in waves, and there's going to be a time where people who aren't doing the right thing are going to have an opportunity to get their act together. But if they don't, he said they're going to either change their behavior or be weeded out. And just, it was like manna from heaven to hear somebody who's going to be in charge of drug enforcement in racing say that, and say that clearly, that you're either going to get with the program or you're not going to be in the sport anymore. And it's just, we need someone like that. We need someone to come in and just bop, 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 just like smack everybody who has been doing the wrong thing for horses until they leave the sport, because nobody in racing has done that. And it, like, you know, when we first passed, and the Heisa was first passed, then we all agreed that this was the most important part of it, was to take the drug enforcement out of the hands of the people in the sport who are so often conflicted and have interests in this continuing to go on. And I'm happy. I would love to, he said he would come back on the show, and I would love to have him back on the show once this stuff starts to, you know, actually come into effect. Heisa doesn't actually come into effect until July 1st, 2022. So there is a little bit of time here for people to adjust. But I just wonder about your thoughts from that interview, guys, because I could not have been happier hearing from him, you know, that the adults are going to be in charge now. I think that's the kind of thing, that was the main takeaway for me, is that no more of this fragmented 38 states with 38 different regulations. The adults are coming in to clean this up and to make everything uniform in the sport, which is something that racing needs more than anything else. Racing's got a lot of problems more than anything else. It needs uniform drug policy to protect the horses.
Joe, he said a lot of things, as you mentioned, that were really interesting, but two sort of stood out to me. One was the use they hope to make of a tip line. And he said that, and I wasn't aware of this. I mean, you know, while they haven't gotten into racing yet, they're still busy dealing with human athletes and the drugging problems in sports and Olympic events and that sort of thing. And he said that one of the most effective things they have out there is a tip line. He even said, he gave a number, 22% of the time, when somebody says, hey, I know this guy in swimming is cheating, take a look at them. He said 22% of those tips lead to guys getting caught. Now, but the problem with that, and it's up to the racing industry. Part of the problem all these years is hear no evil, speak no evil, et cetera. And it's always stunned me how the honest guys, which are 99% of the game, never stand up and scream or point fingers or anything like that. There's kind of almost this, you know, backstretch Omerta type thing. That's got to stop. If somebody is suspicious, hey, you don't have to be right. It's up to Travis Tiger and USADA to figure it out. But, you know, if you saw something going on toward at the bar next to you, pick up that tip line and call them. So hopefully that will have the same success with that in racing that they have in human sports. The other thing I thought was really interesting, we had talked about obviously the federal government and the FBI coming in and catching these guys, but not doing it through drug testing. To me, drug testing doesn't catch people. It catches a guy with a Banamine overage type of thing. You have to have it. I understand that. But I don't think drug testing, even under Travis Tiger, is going to catch the guy who's doing what Jason Service and Jorge Navarro were doing, allegedly doing, which was using allegedly performance-enhancing drugs to improve the horse's performances. But he said that, well, maybe USADA itself can't wiretap people. They have connections with law enforcement people that they can get to work with them. So that was really encouraging, because I think that's how they're not going to catch people by drug testing. I mean, they'll have the best drug testing in the world and it's going to be good, but they're going to catch people the same way the FBI did, with wiretaps, boots on the ground, gumshoe, old fashioned detective work. So I was really impressed by that. And yeah, this can't come soon enough.
I was leery when we were starting off the interview, because I wasn't sure just how forthright and honest Travis could be, you know, based on a lot of things, you know, based on not being involved in the industry yet, not having an understanding and, you know, and footing of who he should look after and, you know, were there political ties and all those things. And by the time the interview was over, I kept thinking back to Kevin Costner's characterization of Elliot Ness in The Untouchables. And basically where he came in and he took on Capone and he took on the mob and basically flipped Chicago and subsequently flipped the United States, you know, flipped the script on all the organized crime. And that's what kept going through my mind when we were doing the interview with Travis. And then when I was watching it afterwards in the finished product, here's a guy who is not in the industry, could give a rat's ass about what goes on to the day-to-day things that, you know, that afflict this industry. He's coming in basically to clean up our mess. And we've been saying it for years that we need somebody outside of the jurisdiction who doesn't have political ties, who doesn't have, you know, oh, well, you know, this guy trains horses for me, so I can't, you know, and pays my bills, so I can't, you know, I have to look the other way on a couple of things. This organization, USADA, and, you know, led by Travis, they're above the industry. They're aside from the industry. They don't really care if it's the horse industry, you know, the cyclists or the Olympic diving team. For them, if a coach or a trainer, in this sense, are cheating, their job is to identify it, get enough evidence, and then get them the hell out of the business. And I couldn't, you know, we were joking before about how we were like, oh my God, this is like, you know, this is so exciting. It really is. For people who do things in the business the right way and follow the rules and then consistently get beat by trainers and organizations that cheat, it's frustrating. It's really frustrating. And you sit here and you say, this business is tough enough as it is to try to get an animal to run as fast as it can naturally and to try to, you know, deal with the horse and its temperament and injuries and the racetracks and the jockeys and the exercise riders and the weather and COVID and all the things that are up against you before you even get that horse into the starting gate of a race. All those things are against you. And then on top of it, when you're, you know, with eight other horses in the starting gate and you're at a flat foot tie, basically at that point with the seven other competitors, and all of a sudden you look and you say, you look down the program and you're like, oh, well, that trainer, I know, you know, I think cheats, and this trainer, you know, takes an edge. And all of a sudden, like, you're running for third or fourth place money at best. So you're like, why am I doing this anymore? Why am I beating my head against the wall? And then you retire the horse and you find out that similar things happen, you know, on medications and surgeries, you know, with young horses that haven't even run, that are just going to the sales. it's a breath of fresh air that you're going to have an organization like this oversee what's going on and make sure that things are done the right way. And to me, that was the most important thing. But, you know, Bill, to your point, I also wrote down on my notes 22%. I mean, that's a huge percentage of anonymous tips. Basically, people who call in and say, I think this person may be cheating based on XYZ. And they take the ball and they do the due diligence at that point. And then basically one out of four tips that they get, you know, convicts somebody. That's a huge number. That means that most people who think, well, fill in the blank trainer or owner is cheating, one out of four of them's right. I mean, that's the crazy part about it. And basically, you know, USADA is set up where they can take these anonymous tips, do their due diligence, do the detective work, and then come up with enough evidence to you know, arraign and prosecute people. I mean, that, and get them out of the business, which is what we all want. We all just want an even playing field and an opportunity. So nothing makes me happier, you know, whether it's July of 2022 or sometime, you know, in future date, it can't come soon enough as far as I'm concerned, because there are just so many egregious, you know, situations. I actually took the 800 number and put it into my phone, because once it's up and running, I'm going to be calling that freaking thing probably every week. And if I'm not right, then I'm not right. But at least then it's like, enough already. We're going to have an idea of who's really, you know, toeing the line and who's not. And that's all I care about.
Yeah. And, you know, the big thing about that is they have, USADA has previous credibility. That is the huge thing. It's not, they're not picking some random political government hack to come in and try to police the sport. They have built up credibility now for two decades of busting cheaters in sports that are much bigger than racing, and people and sports that have much more, I think, political sway and sway with the public than racing. Lance Armstrong was one of the biggest stars in the world. He had the support that he had was enormous across the athletic world and just in culture. And he and Travis Tiger came in there and didn't care about any of that. And USADA busted him regardless of the backlash. And he got death threats reportedly for doing that. He had to have FBI protection. So the idea that he's going to be scared of some of the owners and trainers in this game is just, it's nonsense. And the tip line is so big because, you know, Bill said this before and wondering like why there's this omerta on the backstretch. I think part of it is, you know, there's like a little bit of fraternity with trainers and assistant trainers and all that. But I think another big part of it is that you don't have this uniform body that you can go to. Like what is the racing jurisdiction or the organization right now that you think that you can call with a problem like this and be confident that they're going to do something about it? There isn't one. That's why the FBI had to come in and bust these guys, because there was nobody in racing that had the authority or the willingness to say, even if they got tips from people, to act on them. So that is such a huge thing. The tip line is so huge, to have somebody with authority and credibility who you are confident will do something about it if you report something to them. Because that's enormous. Like, whether or not there is this omerta that Bill's talking about, there definitely are people out there, like John is one of them, who have been seeing this stuff happen on a regular basis and have been dying to, you know, tell somebody who can actually do something about it. And that is an enormous thing to introduce into the industry. The other things that he said that I thought were really impressive was he talked about how this has to be like a whole industry, you know, effort. It can't just be them coming in top down and saying, here's what's going to happen, you know, love it or leave it. There is a part of that. There is a part of having that kind of authority, but he admitted that it's not going to be just them. It can't be just them. And it goes to the tip line, and it goes to a lot of other people, you know, voluntarily doing the right thing. And they're going to need help. They're going to need cooperation from the industry. And the other thing I was really impressed with was that there was no arrogance. There was no like, I have this great resume and we have this great resume of doing all these things, which they do. So we're going to come in and we're going to say this and everyone else can just fall in line. He admitted, he said, look, we have to prove ourselves. We have to prove ourselves to this industry day and night that we are the right people for this job. So there was no, I don't know. He was not presumptuous. He was not arrogant about any of that. Even though, you know, honestly, he had a right to be. I think if I were coming in and policing this mess of a sport, I might be a little bit more like, okay, here's what's going to happen. You guys can get in line or leave. But he admitted, he said, we're going to have to work to earn the trust of the people in horse racing. And I just think that that's the right attitude to have. That even though we have this credibility and even though we've done all of this and this is the reason that we're being brought in, you don't know us from Adam. You know, racing people don't know us. We've never had any interaction with you at all. So this is what we have to do to earn your trust. And then this is what the rest of you have to do to work with us and help us accomplish this goal, which I think is just 100% the right attitude and the right approach to have. And that to me was the most encouraging thing from that whole interview, which was encouraging across the board, was that he understood that he cannot go it alone. USADA cannot go it alone. This has to be a whole of industry approach. And I think that's the way to go for us in the future. And John texted me this after the interview, that if I were one of the juice trainers and they know who they are, and it includes some big time names, I'd be sweating bullets right now. And I would try to get my program in order by next July, because there is a new sheriff in town, and you know, we sorely, sorely needed that. And I was so glad after talking to him, not just because it was a good interview and it was good for the show to have him on, just as a racing fan and observer, I just felt better about the future of our sport going forward after that interview. And I'm looking forward to talking to him again in the future, if we can get him back on, because, you know, this is what racing needs to get its act together. You know, there were the twin scandals of the Santa Anita deaths and then the FBI indictments. And like he said, it created a perfect storm where I think there is an appetite for change now in this industry. Finally, after all these decades, you know, we have, I think, mostly collectively decided that things have to change in order for the survival of the sport to go on. So an incredible, incredible interview. And you know, you guys asked great questions as well. And I thought it was a real service to our listeners and to people in the industry. We'll be right back after this message from Keeneland.
They say the harder the work, the greater the reward. And this is hard work. It's the hours put in before dawn and after dark. It's the sacrifice, the sweat, the failure, and the faith. This is our industry. This is our life's work.
Owning multiple graded stakes winning racehorses like Hard Not to Love and Decorated Invader is attainable with a racing partnership like West Point Thoroughbreds. Partnerships enable you to spread your ownership across several horses for less than it costs to own one horse alone. This increases your racetrack action and your chances for a big horse. Learn more about why West Point Thoroughbreds is the gold standard in racing partnerships at westpointtb.com. Just some housekeeping here. We've talked about this the past couple of weeks, historical horse racing and the bill that was going through the Kentucky Senate. It passed the Kentucky House last week. There was a 55-38 vote in favor of reinstating and legalizing historical horse racing. It was an emotional debate. T.D. Thorne had a good story recapping the debate in the Kentucky House floor. You should go read it on the TDN website. So it looks like now that's going to go to Governor Andy Beshear's desk, and he has signaled his support for signing that. So it looks as if that historical horse racing is going to be back in Kentucky. There are, I think, going to be legal challenges going forward. I think the opponents have promised litigation. And so I don't think this saga is quite over yet, but I think that you can breathe a big sigh of relief if you're in Kentucky right now, that revenue is going to be at least temporarily reinstated and back in the coffers. There's also a debate, a side debate about raising the tax that comes from historical horse racing wagers. I believe it's only 1.5% right now, which I think that they could afford to jack that up a little bit more and not, you know, lose any customers. It's not like horse racing takeout where people are sensitive down to the percentage point with good reason. So that's something that I think still has to be worked out as well. But that's obviously a big development for everybody in Kentucky and Kentucky racing. And it, you know, they have the benefit of you know, that's the sport being so integral to the state, because, you know, you look at like a contrast between that and Pennsylvania, where the governor of Pennsylvania is trying to raid the Racehorse Development Fund for the second time in a year, you know, for $200 million. And, you know, there's nobody really, there's not that many people in Pennsylvania to speak on behalf of the horsemen and the industry to really stop that. Now, hopefully it doesn't go through and Pennsylvania Racing can continue operating, but you know, this is the benefit of horses being so integral to Kentucky's culture and its economy. So we're happy for everybody in Kentucky that got passed. I don't know why on earth you would care so strongly to get rid of it. Like, I mean, I do know why, but it's the family foundations and all the conservative Republicans. Like, they want to ruin everybody's fun. So we're happy that got passed, and we'll keep updating. I expect it to be signed soon by the governor, but that's a good thing. And shout out to everybody, including, you know, the Kentucky Equine Education Project, who really spearheaded, I think, the mobilization of people to pass that bill. And it paid off. So good on everybody who got involved and got organized. That's how you make change in America. And, you know, this is something that obviously is very good for the Kentucky thoroughbred industry, but I think also the thoroughbred industry as a whole. Joining the West Point Thoroughbreds partnership, Vault will see you into the world of instant camaraderie among people surrounding high-class horses and stakes action for a fraction of the cost of trying to do it on your own. Learn more at westpointtb.com. We'll be right back after this message from West Point Thoroughbreds.
All the thrills. Fraction of the bills. Experience the power of the partnership. Change your life, make new friends, and compete at the highest level of thoroughbred racing. West Point Thoroughbreds, the gold standard in racing partnerships. Visit westpointtb.com.
The Green Group Guest of the Week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. With over 500 clients in the horse business, they have proven strategies to save you taxes. Learn more about how they can help you at www.greenco.com. Our Green Group Guest of the Week this week is the CEO of the National Thoroughbred Racing Association, Alex Waldrop. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Glad to be here.
All right, so we have a lot going on in racing right now, so there's a lot to talk about. I wanted to start with the handle trends that we've seen, and this is something that I am extremely optimistic about, as optimistic as you can be. The other guys are a little less optimistic, but I think we saw a positive trend in 2020 that continued in January 2021. Obviously, it's only 1 month of data so far this year with handle going up. But I wonder, whether or not you believe that we gained new fans and new customers in racing in 2020. And then as a follow-up to that, how you think we capitalize on that and keep the new fans that we got, as well as gain new customers going forward?
Well, I would agree. The January 2021 numbers were up, what, almost 10%? And purses are back to almost normal. They had been down early part of last year. That's good news. You continue to have a few number of races and race days, which isn't altogether bad when you think of a declining foal crop. You need to have some adjustment in the number of races. There's, you have to balance that with some reality check here. There were fewer weekend days in January, so that may have impacted this bump, this 10% bump. So you have to tenor your optimism. But you're right. Looking back over last year, the last quarter, and even the last half of last year, we were trending 5-7% up over the prior year. So those trends are very positive. I do think they are related to the fact that new people are coming into the business. They're seeing horse racing as a viable option for the first time. That I think is attributable to a lot of the marketing dollars that were spent in 2020 to get eyeballs on our racing for the first time. And I think that's the way we keep this going. We continue to show our races on television, get more people in front of TV sets, mobile screens, all the many ways, all the distribution channels that we have out there, which are many now and they're growing, that's the way to continue to grow. Another way that I think we have to look at in 2021 is to get on more sports betting platforms. Sports betting is spreading across the country. It's a huge and growing business. If we can just get 5% of the number of people who are now betting on these mobile sports betting apps, so we could get them focused on horse racing, get horse racing on those apps, get common wallets so that people can use money on deposit with FanDuel to also bet on TVG's races, that would be a huge win for horse racing. And I think in 2021, this is the year to really focus on what we can do to piggyback on the success of sports betting in this country to grow our visibility even greater.
Alex, good morning. It's Bill Finley. Thanks for joining us. I want to stay on the same subject that you just talked about, a lot of the good things that are happening in horse racing and about getting new fans, et cetera. And, you know, we all know that still that this sport has some very serious problems and problems that it has to deal with. So the flip side of what you're just talking about, as you look into your crystal ball for the future of horse racing, what are the issues that most concern you? And what are the issues that the industry really does need to tackle so that the future continues to be bright?
Well, let's go back a year ago today. I would have said to you, the biggest challenges facing horse racing and its existence, frankly, are safety and integrity. The broader world that we live in now is looking at horse racing and looking at all sports, and certainly sports and or any activity involving animals. They're looking at those activities differently. And so we had to step up. We have to do things differently. We have to be more responsive to the broad range of concerns about our horses and their safety and the integrity of our racing, including anti-doping measures. With the passage of HISA, the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act, I think we now have a real chance at addressing these problems for the first time in a comprehensive way. I think that's the optimism that I have about that legislation. I know there are challenges and we can talk about those. Funding is an issue that always comes up in people's minds. But bottom line, it is something we had to address. It was existential. Without it, there was a real question about whether people were going to allow us to continue to conduct our business. And HISA gives us a real shot. It doesn't guarantee anything, but it gives us a shot at addressing those issues. Beyond that, sports betting, as I mentioned, it is also, it's an opportunity, but also a threat, because it provides more opportunities for people to use their gambling dollars in places other than horse racing. Now, I've been in this business long enough to remember when we barely had simulcasting. When I started in this business, intertrack wagering in Kentucky between tracks was a new thing. Before then, you just bet during a live meet at one location. Our distribution channels have gone crazy, much broader. But yet you've got so much more competition, sports betting and casinos and all those sorts of things. So those continue to be a challenge. We have to be competitive with those new forms of business. Another area, and this is not an exhaustive list, but we have to look at the way we treat our best customers, the horse players. There's been a lot of talk lately, renewed talk, really, going back to the early 2000s when we at the NTRA, through our NERA study, looked at the impact of robotic wagering or the player who's able to use the algorithms to exploit some of the inefficiencies in our wagering pools, how that's affecting our takeout, how that's affecting our big players. That has to be looked at again. We have to take seriously what impact that is having on the everyday fan, the everyday player. And some tracks, now just recently, I know, kicked out the high volume betting shops out of their certain pick-in pools, pick fives and pick sixes. I understand why they're doing that. They got some criticism, but at least we're thinking about these issues. And they're complicated, complex analyses of what's happening to these wagering pools. It's happening on a macro level, not affecting the guy who comes or watches on television or comes once a year, but it does affect the person who's in there every day. So we have to look at that more carefully. And I think at the NTRA, we began this process back in 2004. And we need, as an industry, need to continue to look at that issue and how it may be affecting our big fan, our big players who horse players who are so really the lifeblood of the business. Lastly, horse ownership. Horse owners are, I would put them right on par with horse players. You got to have owners to have a horse to bet on. I was disturbed last night when I was listening to President Biden talk about some of his ideas, his plans for funding new initiatives like free community college. And he mentioned the deduction that horse owners get for owning horses, race horses. It obviously he doesn't understand exactly A, the economics of horse racing, or B, the actual tax benefits or the tax savings that are in play here. There certainly isn't enough money involved to come anywhere close to covering the cost of community college. We've got an education effort to do there, because those benefits are the difference between someone being an owner and someone not being an owner. So they're vital to the business. They're vital to the 500,000 jobs that horse racing supports across the country. And in the state of Kentucky, just to recently address that issue with their concerns about the continuation of their historical racing. So there are lots of innovations, but we've got to continue to focus on horse owners and making sure that we keep those people incentivized to stay in this business.
Yeah, Alex, as a horse owner, I greatly appreciate you saying that, because sometimes nobody feels bad for the horse owner. You know, people feel bad for the wagers and for the trainers and for the jockeys, but it never seems like anyone's like, oh, poor horse owner, you don't get a tax benefit. But that really is a driving force of a lot of people's interest in the business. It makes it a business and not a hobby.
Well, Jonathan, I wish I knew the guy, the man or woman who created the phrase sport of kings. Whoever started talking about horse racing as the sport of kings, I would like to have a word with that person, because that is an albatross around our necks. Wherever we go, especially in Congress, people look at horse racing and its owners in particular as these privileged individuals who aren't deserving of any treatment like a normal business. And as you know, most of horse racing is made up of normal people, and it employs normal people like you and me. It's not, yes, there are owners at the high level who are wealthy individuals, but that's not what horse racing is about. And so the moniker Sport of Kings has been wrapped around us negatively in so many contexts. And that's one of the things we work against in Congress, is to educate lawmakers about who truly are benefited, who truly are the participants in this business, and how many people it benefits across a broad range of society.
No question about it. And in anticipation of this interview, you know, we all do our research. I went back to a 2019 interview that you did with the TDN. And at the time, we were talking about the industry being at a crossroads because of safety measures and safety issues for the athletes and for the people involved. You know, with everything that was going on in California specifically at the time, you know, with PETA coming in and people banging at our doors saying, you guys aren't doing this the right way, the NTRA stepped up and actually made a proclamation and made an announcement and basically was the spokesperson for the industry and took a leadership role in that, which I really appreciate. One of the things that we talk about is, you know, can there be a centralized group, whether it's the NTRA or whomever, that can actually act as our universal spokesperson? So in negative times, things are addressed, and in positive times, things are promoted, just like there are in other sports.
Well, that's always a challenge. It's always been a challenge for us, even going back to 2008, 2009, when we created the NTRA Safety and Integrity Alliance. The intention at that time was to create a common effort and a common message to be delivered, because you need a common message. Common spokesperson doesn't work if you don't have a common message. If you've got multiple messages coming in and attacking the issue, it gets confused. That's why the Horse Racing Integrity and Safety Act is so important, because we now have a coordinated, centralized effort that we can point to and say, here is our solution. Here's our answer to your concern. And it will be the responsibility of the authority to actually respond to those concerns. And we will be able to point to that as our response. And we will be able to have a common message, a central message. Of course, that's a little naive in the day of social media. As long as you've got Twitter, you're going to have multiple messages on any front, and there are going to be opinions that are going to be debated. But at least we can point to demonstrated methods and opportunities we have created in our business to address these issues. You know, you mentioned California and you mentioned 2019. I personally think that as bad as that situation was in California, it was the catalyst that we needed as an industry to change. And they talk about, you know, never letting a crisis go to waste. And for once in this business's history, we didn't let a crisis go to waste. We don't always do that, but this time we did. We came together around a common message. We created the HISA structure that's in the process of being implemented. And it provides us so many opportunities now to give a better message, but more importantly, to give a better result and a better outcome. Because in the final analysis, it can't be all about PR. It has to be about demonstrated ability. It has to be about achievement. We have to improve on our safety records. We have to see horse safety being elevated to the highest priority, like it is under HISA. We have to see integrity being addressed in a real way with USADA, U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, which is by any measure a credible voice and a credible enforcement arm. Those are the kinds of things that we need to do as an industry. We've now done. So it makes it easy as a spokesperson to now have something to point to and to say, hey, this works. It's going to be real and we're going to address these problems.
Yeah, I mean, we had Travis Tigard on the show last week, and it was a great interview, and it made me feel so much better about the future of racing. So I'm with you 100% on that. You mentioned the funding of HISA. That's a thorny issue right now, because there's not a lot of spare money in horse racing right now. I mean, I certainly don't want it to come out of the pockets of the bettors. We can't afford another takeout increase. Like you said, the ownership is a hard thing to be profitable at. Trainers, I mean, horsemen are the middlemen, but there are a lot of horsemen who are really struggling. What are some of your ideas as to how this could be funded when it goes into effect?
Well, number one, first and foremost, HISA, the authority, is all about centralizing the administration of medication control and racing safety matters. Putting it under one office, there will be significant savings. There'll be efficiencies when you compare costs that we now have for 30 duplicate state agencies. I think 10 years ago, we were spending almost $30 million a year on drug testing, on post-race drug testing. That's an astronomical number. I don't think people realized we were spending that much money on drug testing. We're spending more than that now under the 30 duplicate state agencies. By combining our resources, by having one, it won't be one lab, it will be multiple labs, but by negotiating those contracts, those testing contracts over 5, 6, 10 labs, however many it is, accredited labs, we can get efficiency. We can also get improved quality. We'll know that a test sample coming out of New Jersey will be tested exactly the same as a test sample coming out of California. And so wherever we go across the country, we'll have uniformity, but we'll also have efficiency. The second thing to remember is that HISA contemplates a broader base and a more equitable contribution from all industry participants. So not just one group or one tax will be paying for the costs of regulation. So you have that, the equitable nature of this broader based contribution. States will be required to give a proportionate share. So no one state will be required to pay more than its proportionate share. Another point to keep in mind is that the racing industry under HISA, the racing industry cannot be charged twice for safety or integrity costs. If a state chooses not to collect a fee or whatever the state determines it's going to use to fund the costs of the HISA fee, it can't collect the fee for safety and integrity and hang on to that fee. It has to remit that fee to HISA or has to stop charging it. So the industry can't be charged twice in a given state. And that's important. It protects the industry in a given state from being from states double dipping on safety and integrity matters. The last thing I'll say about that, because it's all yet to be determined, the first bills we'll be going out, I think, April 1 of next year. So we've got some time to get this right and to work with state regulators on this. They go out, I think, April 1 of 2022, and they'll have to make a decision about whether or not to pay it themselves or kick it back to the federal government. But we urge states to not to do one of two things. We don't want states to just reflexively go to a per start fee and to hit owners with that fee. That's not a good solution. And by all means, we don't want states to go to a higher takeout. Takeout is high enough. States are collecting, in some cases, confiscatory excise taxes from the business. It's time to start putting those tax dollars to work for the industry, putting them back in the industry. The savings that you get from these new efficiencies, make sure that those dollars go to HISA and are not put in the pocket for something else, because states are going to radically change the way states regulate. They won't need all the infrastructure they have now. They actually may make some money on this as HISA turns around and may pay them a fee for doing sample collections, doing certain, maybe even doing some boots on the ground investigatory work for USADA. That's up for them to determine. But there may be a way for the state to realize huge savings. And the intention here is for those savings to be redeployed back into the industry at the federal level so that we can get this centralized, uniform testing and enforcement strategy in place.
Alex, I want to take you to a different topic, which I'm sure you've been on top of. The H-2B visa issue has been something that doesn't get reported a lot on, but it's been a real problem for farms, trainers, et cetera, where you had an administration that was not immigration friendly, and it was becoming a lot harder to hire workers. You have a new president who I imagine would have very different views, or does have very different views, on immigrants coming into the country and working. Do you see this situation improving under the Biden administration?
I do. For several reasons. First, right now there's a ban on any visas being issued. There's no cross-border travel allowed because of COVID. That is going to be the case until the end of March, unless President Biden rescinds a proclamation that the Trump administration put out at the end of last year. I don't know whether he will do that or not. COVID's a different matter. We can put that to the side. But right now, there's a ban, so they're not available to anyone. After that, I do think that this administration, certainly the Department of Homeland Security, is going to have a different view of these H-2B visas. And keep in mind now, the H-2B visa is not an immigration visa. It's a foreign worker visa. It only lasted for 10 months. It's a temporary worker visa. And to take advantage of it, trainers have to jump through numerous hoops to prove that they're not hiring foreign workers in lieu of workers that are here already, U.S. citizens, for instance, not always citizens. I mean, green card workers can also be included as well. But so they have to go through a very onerous process to even get to the point where they are eligible to utilize the H-2B process. Then the Department of Homeland Security, under the current rules that were modified once again as part of the broader omnibus bill that was passed in the end of December, the same one that had the HISA legislation in it, the same one that had 3-year depreciation for young racehorses in it, also had a provision in it that allows the Department of Homeland Security to as much as double the cap on H-2B visas from 66,000 to about 125,000 H-2B visas. Still not enough, but at least there's a fighting chance that you can access to them. But to get to those visas, the Department of Homeland Security, in conjunction with the Department of Labor, have determined that those visas are necessary. And so under the past administration, the Department of Homeland Security was always reluctant to have any. They would sometimes do 15, maybe 20,000 new visas, but they would put so many limitations on those visas. For instance, of the 20,000 issued last year, 10 had to be from people coming from Ecuador or a couple of other Latin American countries that were participating in some of the efforts by the Department of Homeland Security to limit the number of folks who were coming in seeking asylum in the U.S. That would go away. That limitation would go away. However, you have to keep in mind, there are two bodies here that deal with this. It's the Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Labor. So the Department of Homeland Security is likely to be more permissive when it comes to allowing foreign workers into the country. But the Department of Labor is probably going to be a little more suspicious of that foreign worker because labor looks at the impact on domestic wages. So it's a different focus. You know, it's one of these red blue issues. You know, Republican Democrat, they both look askance at the foreign worker visa for different reasons. Under Trump, it was more of a concern about border security. Under Biden, it's going to be a concern about protecting U.S. jobs and, more importantly, depression of wages. So we have a different challenge with the Biden administration, but there's a challenge nonetheless. And we're working through that right now. So the focus may be less about Mayorkas, the new head of Department of Homeland Security, and more about the new Department of Labor secretary, who will have a much greater say in this administration than last. But all things considered, the potential is there for significant number of new visas, and we'll be working for those.
Great. And Alex, we've been asking you a lot of tough questions, so I'm going to give you a nice, easy layup at the end, okay? Obviously, you're very dedicated to the industry and for the well-being to make sure that the business continues to prosper and go forward. Who is your favorite horse and why? Because there must be a reason, there must be something, a race or a horse or a person that made you go into this industry that you kind of look fondly upon. Give us Alex's favorite horse or favorite race in your memory.
Well, this one's going to be a little bit of a surprise to you because it's a filly and it's Winning Colors. Why Winning Colors? Why not Zenyatta, Rachel Alexander, two huge horses? I mean, in my history, it's hard to think of bigger horses than those two. Winning Colors, I remember because that was 1988. It was a Derby 1988. My wife and I were expecting our first child, and she was expecting on Derby Day. So we decided in those days you didn't have cell phones. We didn't feel like it was safe to go into the Derby because of the crush. And so we decided to listen on the radio. We went out to a local park and we listened to that race call. And I can remember that race call to this day. And I have been through many, 27, 28 Derbies I've attended in person. I've been in the infield for five or six of them. Not on the winner's stand. And not just in the infield. Actually, I've never been in the infield, just in the infield. I've been on the winner's stand, but never in the infield. That's a very pretentious thing to say, but I don't mean it that way. It's just the way it happened. I never went to the Derby as a college student, I guess is what I'm saying. But Winning Colors sticks in my mind because of the emotional connection. And I think that's what racing does for people. People have emotional connections to these horses. I certainly do. And you remember things, not so much because, of course, it was an incredible achievement and it was a great race. I think she wired, it was amazing. It was big for Lucas. It was a great day. But that horse and that day just stands in my mind. And so she will always be a favorite of mine, maybe my most favorite racehorse. Not going to make the top 10 on anybody else's list, but she's on mine.
Hey, any filly that wins the Derby goes down in history for sure. All right, Alex, thank you so much for the time and for the insight. We really appreciate you coming on and love talking to you.
My pleasure. Look forward to coming back. Y'all take care.
Absolutely.
Appreciate it.
The Green Group guest of the week is sponsored by The Green Group, an accounting, tax, consulting, and advisory firm specializing in the thoroughbred industry. As this week's Green Group guest of the week, Alex Waldrop will receive a free one-hour tax consultation. Learn more at greenco.com. We'll be right back after this message from The Green Group.
The Green Group is widely recognized as the top-rated tax and accounting firm specializing in the horse business. Why do the top owners, breeders, pinhookers, and trainers trust The Green Group as their tax advisors? The difference is experience. Firm founder Len Green has over four decades of experience owning, breeding, and racing horses. First-hand knowledge gives Green Group clients proven tax and money-saving strategies. Visit The Green Group at www.greenco.com. The Green Group, proven strategies to save you taxes.
All right, so that's going to do it for this week's edition of the TDN Writers Room, presented by Keeneland. A reminder that wagering through Keeneland Select supports Keeneland's efforts to give back to the thoroughbred industry. Learn more at KeenelandSelect.com. I want to thank Bill Finley, John Green, our Green Group guest of the week, Alex Waldrop, our producer, Patty Wolf, our associate producer, Katie Ritz, and our editors, Danny Siper, Aaliyah LaRocca, and Anthony LaRocca. Thank you so much for watching. Please wear a mask. We'll see you next week.